Hi there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we're going to explore the rise of music curation in the streaming era. As music streaming platforms continue to dominate the music industry, there's a growing emphasis on the role of curation in enhancing the listener experience. And music lovers want platforms to offer more than just access to a vast catalogue of songs. In this episode, we're going to explore how innovative solutions like Rune are revolutionising music curation, providing super fans with the tools they need to discover, explore and connect with music on a deeper level. I am thrilled to be joined today by the founder and CEO at Rune Labs, Enno van der Meer. Welcome to the podcast, Enno.
Thanks so much, Oisin. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to see you. And just for the benefit of our listeners, we are published in audio. So would you mind describing this kind of synth mothership that's sitting behind you? Where are you joining us from today?
I'm in my office in Cambridge, England, where I have, over the years, cobbled together a crazy collection of modular synths and all manner of studio electronic gear.
Outstanding. I mean, this is literally, you know, synth modular geek heaven behind you right now. It's wonderful to see. How many synths would you say you have there, Enno?
That would be very, very difficult to do. Yeah, I wouldn't even presume to count. No.
Amazing. Enough to lose count. That is, of course, the correct answer. I love it, Enno. Brilliant. So listen, as you can tell by your background, you're surrounded by synths. You're in a place of music. You have had a truly fascinating journey through the world of music, the music business, and also technology. So just so folks can understand where you're coming from and why you are where you are today, could you take us through some of the milestones in that really great career and path to Rune?
Absolutely. I grew up in a fairly musical household. It was very classically focused. My mother was a professional ballet dancer and my father was an amateur musician. So there was a lot of classical music around. I wanted to pursue a career in music, but my parents didn't think that was sufficiently serious. I convinced them to let me go to Berklee College of Music in Boston, provided that I did a major in music production and engineering. So I got into the sort of studio, the electronics side of production. But of course, at Berklee, you have to do a broad base of instrumental and whatever. So that was my early music training. And then I moved to New York for my first gig, which was at Power Station Studio, one of the big iconic recording studios in Manhattan. I think it's actually probably the last one standing of all of those studios from that time. But that was just fantastic to work as an assistant engineer and, you know, meet all the artists, see how these records that I'd been listening to for years were being made. It was that was an incredible experience. And then I started sort of vacillating between this sort of the music world and the tech world, because that was early 90s. It was the rise of the internet. And as a starving musician / composer / engineer, you know, I needed to make ends meet. And I started doing some consulting and building websites and digital marketing and that sort of thing. I ended up founding a company that did that sort of stuff. You know, I've been kind of going back and forth between these two worlds ever since. I managed to escape that world just as it was imploding in the early 2000s. Right around that time, I met a guy named Danny Dulai through a mutual friend. He was sort of the inverse of me, where I was sort of a music guy who knew a little bit about tech. He was a dyed-in-the-wool tech guy who was a big music fan. So we hit it off as friends, and then This is what, late 90s, early 2000s. It's around the time that people start ripping CDs, and MP3 is a word that is kind of in the air. There weren't really great products on the market. There was Winamp. There were very, very rudimentary kind of digital music products on the market. And we thought, well, what? I had a huge CD collection from my music industry background. And we thought, well, you know, what can we do? We can rip these CDs. But how should we rip them? Should we convert them to MP3? Or hard drives were crazy expensive in those days. And I said, no. It's got to be CD quality minimum, because we don't want to step back from that. That would be a terrible step. So we built this giant rack of hard drives. It was preposterous. I mean, I think eventually we spent something like $20,000 putting together 1 terabyte of storage so that we could rip all this music. It was crazy. But the experimentation kind of led us down this path, which was that you can rip all your music, you can get it in one place, and that gives you convenience. So, you know, Winamp gave you that. When iTunes was released in 2001, it gave you that as well. But what we saw was, in terms of user experience, as a music fan, now thinking as a fan, not as a technologist, I've got all my music in one place. This is fantastic. I can listen to anything I want. But what I'm seeing is a spreadsheet. It's like a list of tracks, tens of thousands of tracks. And I thought, well, wait, hang on. I had never really given this any thought before, but the experience of listening to music prior to that, I mean, I'm not a physical media Luddite by any means, but the experience had been, I buy this big 12-inch vinyl LP or even the, you know, the much more modestly sized CD, but I can open it up. I can take out the liner notes as I'm listening to the record for the first time. I can read along with the lyrics and see who the songwriters and the musicians were and where it was recorded and whatever. And that additional layer of information to me was a part and parcel of being a fan. It's not just the listening to the songs. It's understanding who made them and why and who, what the arc of those people's career might have been and who they collaborated with. That was the sort of the ancillary knowledge that you built up over time that distinguished you as a real, real music fan. And that's kind of how I saw it. But I had never articulated any of these ideas. So when I found myself looking at the spreadsheet that Danny and I cooked up, I was like, this is a problem. I don't have any of that other stuff. The other part of the experience is completely gone now. So the first kind of experimentation we did, this was just as a hobby, just for fun, was how can we add metadata, so information about the music, to the music so that I can feel, I don't need to feel like I'm looking at a, you know, liner notes, but I need that bit. And frankly, we're going into the 21st century. The internet is everywhere now. We have access to so much more data. Shouldn't we be able to do even more than the vinyl jacket? We should be able to find even more information that isn't on the vinyl. So that idea was the seed that became this line of products that we've worked on over the years. We messed around with that as, like I said, as a hobby. And after a few years, we looked around and said, you know, iTunes hasn't actually evolved. You know, Winamp is still the same as it has ever been. There was no streaming yet, obviously, and there were, you know, no smartphones or whatever. So we thought, well, maybe we should take this thing that we've been cobbling together and make it into a product. But the problem was that in those days, people didn't have smartphones, tablets, anything like that could provide this touch interface that we thought was very important. So we ended up building a big, crazy hardware system with a 17-inch touchscreen and storage units and network streamers. Because it was a big pile of hardware, it was prohibitively expensive. So that was our first product. It was called Sulus. I mean, it was great fun to make because, you know, instead of seeing this spreadsheet, you'd see all your album cover art and you could open up an album and you could read the credits and you could click through to the other artists. And it was sort of the first iteration of what later became Rune. Many years later, evolved into Rune.
Outstanding. I totally relate to that. I can remember those days of seeing basically a big spreadsheet of all your music with very little other information. And it did feel like we were losing context, we were losing those associations, and also we were losing quality. Now, I love what you said there, is that any product you were making, it had to be CD quality minimum because we had the technology and you were very much at the vanguard of this high quality digital audio access and curation and platforms to put all your music on. What are your thoughts on the state of streaming quality today? I mean, we're in a world of streaming, we're in a world of many different digital files, but what's your take on quality?
Well, I think early on in streaming, if you look at Rhapsody, the first, you know, sort of commercial streaming service, they were, they used lossy encoding as a practical matter. It was a requirement back then. People were still on dial-up modems in many cases. The idea of having high bandwidth content was not really on the menu in those days. So it was a necessity. There's obviously an economic, you know, factor here. It costs money to send people bigger files. So there's that aspect as well. But as time goes on, bandwidth becomes less expensive and storage is basically trending towards free. So, you know, some of those commercial factors they're less of a factor than they were in the past. There are many formats out there, lossless, lossy, all different kinds of sample rates and bit depths and encoding methods. I won't weigh in on any of them specifically, but broadly speaking, the idea that we should have access to the highest quality that we possibly can, given the technologies in the market, seems like an obvious thing to do. I mean, you know, if 4K display technology is available, why would you have a VGA monitor? You wouldn't. It doesn't make any sense. So let's embrace the available technology, get the best quality we possibly can. I set CD as a baseline in those days because we'd already had CDs for 20 years at that point. So the idea of stepping back from that seemed terrible. Also, we were making a product that involved ripping CDs. It was pre-streaming still. So the idea that you would take a CD that was one quality and you'd reduce the quality of that to put it on your hard drive to give you a better user experience, that felt terrible. So, you know, cost be damned, let's at least go with what we've got. And of course, now there are many more choices. Like I said, I won't weigh in on the specific formats. Everyone has their own sort of opinions about that. But the higher the quality, the better, I think.
Amen. Absolutely. That's music to my ears. But talk to us a bit about how we are living in this age of the streaming revolution. And we really have an infinite jukebox. There's a huge amount of tracks going up every day, but it's also overwhelming. So what do you think that streaming and this infinite jukebox means to the user experience?
This is something, in those early days of experimentation, this was one of the ideas that we kicked around. In the late 90s, the idea that you would have access to, quote, all the music in the world was a staggering idea. We couldn't even get our heads around that. But we talked about it, sort of, it was an academic question, right? There was no sign of that becoming a reality at that point. But we thought, well, clearly, if we follow along this arc, sooner or later, we'll get there. What are we going to do when we get there? Because in a physical media world, you have a collection. You buy albums over time and you collect them, and that's your stuff. And that's knowable by a single person, whether I have 50 CDs or 500 or 5,000. That's all stuff that I have somehow curated by going to a shop, buying it, taking it home and listening to it. And so I have context for all of that stuff that I have collected. Now you step out of that world into a world where there are whatever, 200 million tracks or whatever the streaming services have these days, and you're faced with the tyranny of choice. There's simply too much. I mean, I think there's a Bruce Springsteen song about cable TV, about this idea that there's, a million channels and what do you watch, right? That kind of thing. That's what we're faced with in music. And I think it's really very daunting. It leads to a couple of things. In the context of what I'm about to say, you'll see why Rune is the way it is. This idea of saying, I found this thing out in the world of 200 million tracks, but I want to bring it into my world, into my library or my collection and make it mine, whether or not I have the file. This idea that it's over here, so I understand it, it's part of my stuff, and I want to use that as a jumping off point for further exploration. That's kind of what we were doing. We're saying you can't tackle the 200 million tracks. And just picking a genre is still too broad. Knowing that you like country music is not an effective piece of or useful piece of information in trying to provide you a good user experience as a listener. Because if you look at all of country, it's still far too broad for your needs. So this is the kind of thing that we were trying to tackle. Because Sulus and later Rune, they started off with people using their own digital file collections as the starting point, we had a little bit of a cheat code that I don't think the early streaming services had, which is if you had, let's say you had 100 CDs for the sake of argument, I'm sure you probably had a lot more than that, but let's just say you had 100 CDs and you ripped them, you had them on your hard drive. Now, Rune fires up and sees those 100 CDs. It's got a pretty good idea from the get-go of who you are and what you like. So we can use that as a fingerprint now, and we can make more sensible and sensitive recommendations for stuff outside your library because we know this bit about you. The early streaming services were really up against this, where the first time you launch that app for whether it's Rhapsody or Spotify or what have you, they know nothing about you. They have no idea. So, they came up with a variety of sort of user experience ploys to say, what genre do you like? Name a few of your favorite artists, whatever it was to get that fingerprint to provide you a reasonable experience. But still, I think the technologies that were available at the time were fairly basic. What a lot of people complained about was, I don't know where to start. I've got a search box. That's too scary. Right. And so what you see is that if you watch people use their streaming apps or certainly if you watch them interacting with a voice assistant like Alexa or what have you, the interaction is very much, oh, wait, I've got this song on my mind. Search for that and play it. And that's the end of the road. And then so it's, search for another song and play it. You're really constrained by what you can think of in the moment that you might like to hear. And for me, coming from the world of having a record collection, this idea of browsing or going to a record store and browsing, that was cool because I need serendipity. I need happy accidents to happen to me. This is what happened. I open the New York Times app to read an article that's caught my eye, but then I glance over into the sidebar and there's another article that I hadn't even known I would be interested in. And boom, now I'm down a whole other rabbit hole. That phenomenon, that serendipity is the thing that we think is critical in media consumption. You don't always know exactly what you want at any given moment.
Yeah, 100%. So you've kind of teased a bit about what Rune does, why it does it, where it's come from. But for the uninitiated, how would you describe the Rune experience? So I've just hit subscribe, I've installed Rune. What happens next?
Okay, there are two sides to it. There's one that I think of the music experience side of it, and there's the other side of it that's the audio. I'll tackle them separately. On the music side, Roon will first look at your files, assuming you have some local music files. It will scan them all, identify them, figure out what you've got. If you hook up a streaming service, so for example, you put in your Tidal or your Qobuz or KKBOX credentials into Roon, it will look at the streaming service and see, well, what have you favorited? What have you listened to? That sort of thing. And from that, Roon identifies all that music, builds you what we think of as the library. It could be an actual library of files. It could be a virtual library of streams, but it's a library. It's your collection of music. It's the stuff you've pulled together over some period of time, and this is your stuff. Then what Roon does is it goes out and it says, okay, I've got this 100 albums, this 1,000 albums, this 10,000 tracks, whatever it is. What other information is there out in the world about that? That could be album cover art, credits for who performed, who wrote songs, who did the production and engineering, lyrics, artist biographies, high-res photos, tour dates. So I've got an album by this artist. Is that artist on tour? If so, when are they playing near me? All this kind of information, Roon goes out in behind the scenes and pulls that together. So now when you go to listen to the artist or the album or the track that you like, Roon's showing you all this additional information about it. And you landed on a word earlier. I think if there's one word that summarizes what Roon tries to provide you, it's context. So I love this song, but I mean, I often think of it this way, that you can love a song, but you're a fan of the artist. The connection that you feel is to the people who made the music that you love. You know, you don't have a connection to a song itself. So that's what Roon tries to show you. You like this? Well, maybe here's why you like it. Here's the person who played bass, and here's the songwriter, here's the whatever, and here's the sort of the interconnected web of the way these people interact. So the Roon user experience is not about search and play or browse through a list and play. It's here's the thing that you're looking at. Here are links out to 100 other places that might be interesting from here. So if you love this song, well, here's 10 other songs that songwriter wrote, and they could be by different artists. You end up going down vectors that you wouldn't pursue necessarily if you were only searching by artist or by song title or by album title, that sort of thing. So Roon presents you all of that. And it's very much, when I talk about it being interconnected, that's really the key, that it's not like a folder tree in Winamp or in iTunes. It's, I found this thing. Oh, look, here are six other paths that I could take from here. It's this forward moving journey. Oh, I'll check out this next thing. I'll check out this next thing. And frankly, that's the feedback that we get from many of our users, is that they end up using Roon and binge listening in the same way that you might binge watch a series on Netflix. People sit on the sofa with their tablet and play a track and then discover, oh, wait, I could check out this other thing as well. And then they end up sitting there till 2 a.m. because there's always one more thing to explore from where they are. To us, that's the main metric of success. How long have you sat and listened? How long have you poked around? If that number is big, then we feel like we've succeeded in our product design. That's kind of how we look at it. That's the music experience side of the house. On the audio side, so Roon builds you this library, it gives you this way of browsing it and exploring it. And then the audio side is how you play it back. So if I'm on a tablet, of course, I can listen on the tablet, but I might want to listen on my hi-fi setup in my living room or whatever. I might want to listen to some, you know, wireless radio that I've got on the kitchen counter or some whole home audio system. I want to listen wherever I am. If I'm a music nerd, and believe me, I am, then I want to listen in every context. I want to be able to light up my whole house with music if I want to. So this whole music streaming around the home is the other side of it. And now historically it's been around the home. So I could play music in all different rooms. I could play different music in different rooms. I could sync them all together and play the same thing everywhere, whatever. That's the home audio side of it. And then in the last few years, we introduced a sort of a companion app to Roon that we call Arc. And what that does is it's a phone app that lets you take that same user experience outside of the home. So when you're in the car, you can still have access to your library and all of your stuff and tags and playlists and favorites and whatever else. Arc is the app that lets you, whether you're at the office, in the car, at the gym, on holiday, that sort of thing, it lets you have your whole library and all of Roon's features wherever you are.
Phenomenal. So Rune is basically the best music buddy you've ever met. It's kind of pointing you in this direction, adding this context, making these links. And it doesn't feel like it's a recreation of a experience that we had earlier, like with Sleeve Notes, etc. It's all of these things. It's actually the next evolution of the music listening experience. One that will, like you say, kind of sit alongside the main kind of movie streaming platforms, etc. So it really has brought things up to date in a way that I think nobody else has done. But talk to us a bit about what's happening under the hood, because obviously, you know, I do indeed have more than 100 CDs like your good self, I imagine. And, you know, folks who are getting involved in Rune will have very significant collections and from different sources. So I believe that AI plays a role under the hood of the Rune experience. Talk to us a bit about what's happening and how you bring this all to life.
Well, AI is obviously a very broad term. It's a very popular one at the moment. I think what we're seeing in mainstream press at the moment is an evolution of technology that's been in broad use for quite a few years by Rune and many, many others, of course. In the early days, what we did was we said sort of I'll use the term machine learning rather than AI, because I think it's a little bit more specific. Prior to the widespread use of machine learning, I feel like Rune could do a very good job, and Sulus in the days before Rune, using metadata. We might say that if you're listening to this, based on the metadata, so who wrote it, who performed it, what label released it, what year did it come out, what country was it released in, all that sort of stuff, we could make some sensible recommendations based only on the metadata. So if you took a simpler approach and used only genre, right? So now you play a hard rock track, and now the recommendation that we're going to give is another hard rock track. The results are not going to be good. It's far too broad, right? So by using these additional dimensions of metadata, we could say, well, you've listened to a hard rock track from the 70s that was recorded in England. Okay, we can do a lot better now. We can make something that's going to feel more sensible to you, that will cause you to bristle less as a music fan. And so in the early days, we did the best with the data that we had available. And that was really just this metadata. Over time, what machine learning has allowed us to do is something that's a little bit esoteric. And that is to say, what we try to do is to build a model of, I'll call it music knowledge. So a model of how all the recording artists that we know of are interrelated, how similar they are to one another. It's actually very hard to imagine what this model would look like, because you can't really visualize it. You could project it in two or three dimensions and get a sense of what it looks like. It's like a cloud, but the underlying data is not that. It's something that I think the human brain has a hard time understanding, because it's so multidimensional. If you knew everything that there was to know about every recording artist who had ever recorded, your head would explode. But I mean, if you could know that, how would you represent that information? It's very, very hard to say. So what I do when I look at the models that we've built is we get projections of them. So those could be, like I said, two or three dimensions, let's say. So you picture this cloud and you pick an artist that you know, and then look at what are they adjacent to? What are they near? What other artists are they connected to? And when you look at this data, it makes a lot of sense. Like, yeah, that's about right. I get that. I can see why, I'll just take a random example, why Nora Jones sits at a weird fulcrum between a bunch of jazz artists that I know and maybe some more folk or country or, you know, adult contemporary artists that I know. That feels right intuitively to me as a music fan who knows Nora Jones and her career. Yeah, I get that. But the idea that you can build this model based on partly on the metadata, but then partly also on, and this is where we have a little bit, again, another cheat code, which is that Rune is a product for music nerds. It always has been, which means that the people who use it are very particular in their listening. They're not just throwing on the radio for background music. They're nerds. So when we look at the listening history of our users, we get unbelievable data, because our users will have their pet crazy niche subgenre, and they will plumb the depths of it in their listening. Now, that teaches this model far more nuanced understanding of that subgenre than you would get just by scouring all the metadata. So one of the main tools that we use in building these models is what Rune users listen to. That's been quite amazing. And now, so you've got that model now, and now I can come in as a new Rune user and say, well, here's 100 things that I have. And here's the thing I feel like listening to right now. Now, project that into that model and say, what next? Where do I go from here? It gives us something, it's really quite cool. The recommendations that Rune makes are, they're described as being sensitive. You know, they make sense to you as a fan. We've got a couple of features that use this. We have some in the browsing experience. So if I'm looking at an artist, I may be recommended some of their content, some of their releases. I might be steered towards some other similar artists or that sort of thing. But also we've got a feature called Rune Radio where you play one track or one album, whatever you feel like listening to, and it will just use that as a seed and then kind of go from there in the same way that Pandora did many years ago. In terms of user experience, it's the same, but the results that we get, I think, are far more nuanced. Pandora was using the, you know, their music genome data is what they called it, which was all metadata driven, tempo and key and whatnot. And we're using this machine learning model, which is gives you much more interesting recommendations. So I've discovered a ton of music by just picking a track and letting Rune build a playlist for me. And then I sit back and say, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And I, you know, that's one of my main mechanisms for discovery these days.
I love it. My goodness. As you were talking there, I was just thinking about certain tracks that I'd like to put into Rune Radio and just see where it takes me. It is a listening experience that is unlike anything that has gone before. It's everything we love from albums and CDs and cassettes, etc., and streaming, but it overlays all of this magical, musical, multiverse mothership on top of it. It's absolutely fascinating. Now, my first awareness of Rune was through some brilliant new products, which were labeled as Rune Ready. And I thought, oh, what's this? This sounds amazing. And in particular, the JBL MP350, which is a gorgeous piece of equipment. And so I was absolutely thrilled to read about the deal that your good selves have done with the good people at Harman. So talk to us a bit about that deal and how did it come about?
Well, actually, before I do that, you touched on this idea of Rune Ready, and I want to cover that quickly because it's important, and I think it's defined our trajectory in many ways. Because one of the problems that we, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's this music experience side to Rune, and then there's the audio, what we think of as the plumbing, how does it all work? On the audio side in those days, we launched Rune in 2015, and in those days, it was if you had music in one place, it was not trivial to make it play in another place. There were a few protocols. There was UPnP, which was this big loosey-goosey open standard. There were some proprietary solutions. Apple had AirPlay and so on. We started with Rune. We said, well, let's be compatible with as many of those things as we can so that we can kind of slot in. But we said, none of these streaming protocols, these LAN streaming protocols, really ticked all the boxes in terms of what we thought Rune should be able to do. So we thought it's got to be able to stream in high resolution. It's got to be able to let the audio device at the end of the chain control the clock and the stream for optimal quality. That's something that, for example, AirPlay didn't do. So we wanted that. We knew that high-end audio brands would want to be able to control the audio stream. So that was a requirement. Then we wanted to have bi-directional control. So if you have a streaming integrated amplifier that's got a big volume knob on the front, if you turn that knob, we want the volume slider in Rune to move. And likewise, if you change something in Rune, we want that to be reflected on the hardware device. So we wanted this two-way control. These three things didn't exist in any of those streaming protocols. So we developed one of our own, which we called Rune Advanced Audio Transport. And we thought, how are we going to convince audio manufacturers to adopt this new protocol? I mean, we have a vanishingly small number of users. We're a brand new company. This is basically, we packaged that up as an SDK and we said, okay, manufacturers, you can have it for free and we'll help you with your implementation and your testing and your certification and whatnot. So, you know, a few intrepid brands started off, you know, I guess it's in 2016, started implementing this, and that sort of picked up momentum over time. And then we introduced this idea of Rune Ready. This device is Rune Ready. All you have to do is buy it, take it home, plug it in, put it on your network, and Rune will see it. And the rest will all just happen as if by magic. That was the goal. But also at the highest possible quality. We want Rune to be able to take advantage of every feature of this new audio device you've bought. So that's what it means to be Rune Ready. We attracted hardware manufacturers over the years and kind of finally hit a tipping point where most of the high-end audio gear out there became Rune Ready. Now, that's where we first started working with Harman, with a number of their brands, with Arcam, with Mark Levinson, with JBL, to make their devices Rune Ready. So we've been working with Harman for quite a few years in that context, getting their devices certified and whatnot. Harman approached us about a year and a half ago, the first time, to say, you know, could we do anything more together? it was very broad. And that sort of kicked off a series of conversations over 2023 and eventually led down this path. They asked us, quite frankly, you know, what you've done very well. You've built up this very loyal group of users. The company is profitable despite being a tech startup. They basically said, what more would you want to do? What would you need? What can you not do because of your configuration as a startup? And we said, well, there's a lot of things we could do with more resources. And they said, well, that's probably an area where we could help you. It was a very sort of complementary situation because Harman is probably best in class as far as device manufacturer. They build hardware better than almost anyone, but they don't have a lot of competency in our area. We are allergic to hardware. That's not what we do at all. But the software end of things, we spent quite a lot of time on. So it was a very good fit in that respect. But also there's some cultural things that came up that were very, very important. For example, Harman values kind of an entrepreneurial spirit. I think we've been approached probably once a year since the dawn of time. Would you want to be acquired? Would you want some deeper partnership and whatever else? And in a lot of those cases, those discussions would have resulted in Rune becoming a feature of some other product, for example. And that we just didn't want to go that way. So Harman, they liked the idea that we were innovative and they wanted to sort of nurture that and foster more of it. And they said, you tell us what it's going to take to make Rune bigger, better, you know, whatever. What you tell us what your aspirations for it are, and let's see if we can support those aspirations. So that's very much been the tenor of our conversation, which is fantastic. We'll say, look, we don't know about hardware. They're comfortable saying, you guys are the experts on software. So it's a very nice fit in that respect. The other thing is that you might have guessed that certainly as a manufacturing sort of behemoth with all these different brands, Harman could have come in and said, well, Rune's great, but we'd like it to work only with Harman products. And they did quite the opposite. They were quite insistent that this idea of, it's not open in the open source sense, but it is a very sort of inclusive ecosystem that we've built. They've said, well, that was your strategy from the get-go. We don't want to change your core strategy. So you've got to keep doing that. And they were insistent, which, I mean, to me, that was fantastic. For a hardware manufacturer to think that way is quite unusual. So we were very pleased about that. They've given us the sort of free rein to say, do what you want, you know, grow in whichever directions you like, which is pretty fantastic. So I feel very fortunate for the way things have gone.
Fantastic. I'm so happy to hear that. I mean, all of my interactions with Harman, I've been to their labs in Northridge. I've met a ton of people who work there and they're all music lovers. They all want what's best for the listener. I love the example of their support for the research of Dr. Sean Olive in defining the Harman curve. I mean, this is something that benefits the entire industry, but they really did invest in it. And I think you have that lovely kind of benign partnership, as you described it, with Harman as well. So what kind of resources does this partnership with Harman open up for the team at Rune, would you say?
There are a couple of them. I think the most obvious one is that in hardware, I mean, we've long manufactured a hardware product. It's called a range of products called Nucleus. Because Rune runs on a PC, most people start running it on their laptop, Mac or Windows, whatever. Rune runs on a fairly heavyweight piece of hardware in your home. And that's not ideal for everyone because what we see is over time, fewer and fewer people have full-time PCs in their home. They're using phones and tablets and whatnot. So I think in 2018, we launched the first version of this product called Nucleus, which is basically just a mini PC. In terms of what hardware it is, it's quite vanilla. It's a mini PC in a fanless chassis that allows us to install an operating system of our design and the Rune software on a box. So it basically takes Rune and takes it from being a desktop app to being an appliance. You buy the Nucleus, power, network, turn it on, and that's it. You're done. Now, all you have to do is pick up your phone or your laptop or PC, if you like, and connect to that. And that now runs your house. So it becomes sort of the audio hub of your home. So we've been making that product for years. I mean, when I say we've been making it, that's actually quite charitable. We specified what it had to be, and we've worked with contract manufacturers, and we worked very closely with Intel and with Gigabyte over the years. We basically integrate this product, and our software is the piece that we add. So we don't do any manufacturing. We don't have a factory, obviously, but we have made this line of hardware products, which has been very widely adopted among Rune users. So with Harman, we can obviously, we have tremendous hardware manufacturing resources that we never had access to. So that gives us cost benefits. And I think that's played out recently. We've just introduced the new generation of Nucleus products. One is a flagship, which is extremely high-end, fanless, audiophile grade, everything. But the other one, you know, it's far more entry level. It's the previous Nucleus generation had been priced at $1,500 US and $2,500. This new one is $499. We've really kind of broken the mold. And that's something that Harman allows us to do because they've got the scale, they've got the manufacturing, the distribution, things that we just didn't have access to. So on the hardware side, obviously, Harman gives us huge benefit there. In terms of what we can do with software, you can imagine if you're a software startup that's self-funded, no external funding like we were, you hire a new engineer when you have the revenue to be able to do that. That's how you grow. It's like, oh, we made more money this month than we did last month. We can hire a person. Great. And so you're growing kind of incrementally. And what you don't get to do is have the big blue sky idea and say, we need a team of 10 or 20 on that idea for 18 months before it bears fruit. You just can't do that stuff because it's too risky, it's too costly. And if that thing doesn't succeed, if it doesn't take off the way you imagine, you're sort of doomed. we couldn't have done those kinds of projects. And Harman has said, sky's the limit, guys. What do you want to do? Like, just tell us. If you need... you need more engineering resources. You need more product development resources. Whatever it might be, build those teams, go do that stuff. And that has been, I think, not only the most liberating, but the most exciting thing. We've been able to think not so much tactically, what's the next feature that we can build in 6 weeks, but much more strategically, like what might listeners want in a year from now? And what can we do to try to predict that and try to build some product that will meet their needs at that scale? So it's very, very exciting.
Phenomenal. This is such good news for music lovers. I am so excited to see what comes next. Is there anything that you can point to at this stage and say, you know, look out for this forthcoming XYZ from Rune and Harman, or is that confidential?
I don't think I can point to anything specific. I'll tell you what we've been doing, something that we weren't able to do before, which is that we've introduced a new release cadence for our software. So we used to release huge versions of Rune, huge updates that would come once a year, thereabouts. We've got a new 2-week release cadence. So every 2 weeks, we're dropping new features or huge stability improvements, that sort of thing, just so that we're basically going through the backlog of ideas that we've come up with over the years and said, let's build them all fast and release them. Speaking as an end user of other products, that excites me to see activity, to see a product evolving quickly. To me, that inspires confidence. So the products that I use in my real life, I love to see that. So we're trying to emulate that. So we're actively developing Rune. Another thing that Harman has said, we thought maybe they'd want to go very extremely mass market and sort of dumb down the product and make it for everyone. And they've said, no, you know, Rune is a niche product for a reason. It meets the needs of a very exacting audience, and it would be a real shame to dilute that. So let's double down on that. Let's give the audiophiles and the deep, you know, music enthusiasts every feature that they have ever asked for. Because if you've got that in the stable, if those are your core features, now you can do all kinds of things that you couldn't have done before. If you've built everything already, you can release subsets of that as, you know, in other forms to other audiences. But let's not lose sight. Let's never lose sight of this core, hardcore audience.
Phenomenal. Okay, I've got one more question for you. It may be a bit of a leading question, but would you say that Rune is the final boss level of music listening?
For a certain type of listener, that has very much been the objective. I feel like I've encountered music fans and listeners of every stripe over my career and also my personal life. I would consider most of my friends to be music fans, but what they want varies quite a lot. I know a lot of people, for example, who are huge music fans and not audiophiles. They're, you know, they'll sort of take or leave the sound quality. I've noticed, especially dealing with my kids, they listen to music very differently than I do. So their needs are different. They've grown up in a world of this sort of ephemeral streaming content, very fast paced, high volume, listen fast, choose whether or not you like it. They have a different sort of mental setup but they're equally enthusiastic about music on the whole. So I think Rune is the final boss level for people of a certain disposition and maybe of a certain generation, and that would include me. But I think the aspiration is to evolve it, to become more inclusive, to meet the needs of more kinds of music fans. It could be that in the world, this is my sort of back of the napkin math, I think that probably 90% of people enjoy music, but could take it as a background thing, and probably 10% want to lean into it and, you know, and whatever. We're always going to target that 10%, whether you're a 14-year-old, like my daughter doing her crazy stuff that she does, or you're someone like me. That's the class of customer that we're always after. We want to provide that listener with everything they could possibly want and hopefully surprise them from time to time with stuff they didn't know they wanted.
Outstanding. My goodness. All of this is very enticing. I'm going to be watching this space with great interest. And okay, we are going to round up the podcast as we do with every single episode of Audio Talks by inviting our VIP guest, your good self, to contribute a track to our title playlist. And if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about why you chose it.
I've struggled mightily with this question, I have to tell you, to distill everything down into one track. I'm picking a track from an album that I have been listening to recently. It came out last month, I think. It's from an album by Jacob Collier called Jesse Volume 4. Well, I've been following Jacob for years, like I think a lot of music nerds have, people with music backgrounds. He's been a little bit of a sort of a phenom in the world just because of his musicality and the, you know, his capabilities as a multi-instrumentalist. His understanding of harmony goes well beyond, I think, what I've seen almost anywhere. So his latest albums, Jesse Volume 4, it's especially interesting in Rune because, you know, Jacob's first album, In My Room, he played every single thing on the album. He literally recorded it in one room in his mother's house in London. These last four albums that he's done have really been focused on collaboration with artists from all over the place. So, you know, R&B and jazz, rock, country, folk, hip hop, all over the place. So what Rune lets you do when you're browsing an album like that, you really can see all these connections. I've discovered more artists just by listening to Jacob's last few albums than I would have done otherwise. So picking a track off this album is really, really tough, but I chose a song called Wherever I Go, which has a bunch of guest artists from different generations that you'll see if you look at it, Michael McDonald and Lawrence, this sort of up-and-coming band. It's a favorite of mine at the moment.
Oh my goodness, thank you. Well, I'll be diving into that with many of our listeners immediately after the recording. And of course, dear listeners, you can find this in our title playlist. It's going to be linked in the show notes. And I'm going to add to that title playlist just because I am looking forward to seeing where Rune takes me if I start listening with this track. It is as sampled by Pete Rock and CL Smooth in They Reminisce Over You. It's Tom Scott with Today, that I believe is a cover of a Buffalo Springfield record. It's just beautiful, kind of hippie jazz. It's just absolutely magnificent. And I can't wait to see what associations Rune and Rune Radio pops up when I play it next. Okay, listeners, thank you so much for joining us. And a big thanks to our very special guest, Enno van der Meer. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's been so much fun. I hope you're all going to go and get on Rune immediately after the podcast. We'll be linking, of course, to the Rune platform and websites in the show notes. So, my dear friends, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talk series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps listeners to get to know about the super connected audio mavens we talk to in every single episode, like Enno van der Meer. For more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more superbly curated Audio Talks. See you next time.